want to thank Bruce for asking me up here, and Moira for the nice treatment, picking me up at the airport and showing me my nice room. And later on, we left. Not really. She came back, picked me up. We had a terrific dinner. And here we are. Saturday night, we're all alcoholics and in an AA meeting. Can you believe it? You know where we should be? We should all be sitting in a bar somewhere getting ready to go back to work next Tuesday. And also, don't forget, tomorrow's National Guilt Day. So give her a phone call. Your yearly call. Moira and I were talking about my mother, whom I... That's another story. Anyway, yeah, tomorrow is Mother's Day. So, I am glad to be here. In fact, I'm glad to be anywhere, considering what I was and what I did to myself out there, just like the rest of you. And but before I go any further, I want to congratulate the people who stood up for whatever you stood up for. I was so self-obsessed, I really wasn't paying much attention. You know, the national anthem of Alcoholics Anonymous is, "I am always on my mind." I welcome the newcomers. And just remember one thing, I'll give you a tip. When we say, "Hi, how are you?" we don't mean, "How are you?" That's just a greeting. We don't care how you are. We know how you are. We just want to start telling you how we are. You know, that's what coffee breaks or before meetings are all about. Everybody talking, no one listening. And I don't know about you, but there's one of our prayers has, when two or more are gathered together, God is with us. Well, I could be alone and have two or more gathered together some days because, you know, I have that proverbial committee that goes on. And I mean, I just like, I would just settle to be a schizophrenic, because then there'd only be two of us. But some days, I mean, there are a lot of me, and you know, like in the morning, the K-Self, the radio station K-Self, will click on and it'll say, "Good morning, Riley. Today, all things being equal, you lose." Now, I used to buy that when I was newer, and I'd just cover up my head and turn the electric blanket up to Mother, and I wouldn't leave bed for hours. But today, I just tell my head, "Okay, I'm getting out of here. If you want to come along, fine." That, bless you. That's how it is. However, the other night it got going. I mean, the other day it got going. It was rattling on all day. And finally I said, "Oh, God, I'm going to go have a good dinner somewhere." And so I went in this nice restaurant, and the maitre d' came over, and guess what he said? He said, "Good evening, sir. How many out there are you?" And I felt like saying, "Give me the banquet room." And I'm 23 years sober, so don't think it gets any better. If you're worried, that's your message of hope, newcomers. Go ahead and get involved in your first year. We don't care. there's one good thing about getting involved, getting into a relationship your first year, you call your sponsor a lot more. There's some instructions in the book about getting, you know, involved too soon, getting involved, you know, or too soon, whatever that is. We should have a learner's permit to get involved with anything. It says in the book, do not be discouraged if your person does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again. You're sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you have to offer. Now that actually, newcomers, is for the 12-step work, but it works equally well 13th. But so I know, I've been there. I've had four relationships in AA. The first three weren't painful enough. Now, the fourth one, I was the only one involved. And that's hard to break off. I mean, but I was, you know, what I was like out there, and I brought it into AA for quite a while until I finally got something straightened out in this so-called brain of mine. My MO out there was a line from a co-porter too, and it goes, taunt me, hurt me, deceive me, desert me. I'm yours till I die. And the person I picked on, their MO was always tease, thrill, torture, kill. And then that's a marriage, you know, made in heaven for me. I mean, I was always the victim. I came in here a professional victim. I knew how to suffer, and I knew how to let you think I was suffering. Although, believe me, the victim practices the tyranny of the weak. They are in control. If I let you know that you're hurting my feelings, that I'm weak, then I'm in control. I know how to get you. I know how to get you to say I'm sorry. I don't do that much anymore. Some things change. Mara and I were talking about change. One of my early sponsor, bless his heart in heaven, Eddie Regan, told me, he said, now some people come into AA and stay sober for 30 years, and the only thing that changes is their breath. Now, I do not choose to be one of those people. I came in here for, I didn't know I was going to have a better way of life. I didn't know what to expect when I came in here. But as I stayed here longer and longer, I knew I wanted what you people seem to have. And that was a bit of contentment and joy and freedom and humor and laughter. I hadn't heard real laughter for a long time. And I came in here and I heard people laughing at the most awful things. And I said, whatever they're laughing at, I want to know. I want a part of that. And I finally got to that point. My sponsor said, Riley, if you start speaking or when you start speaking, be sure and keep humor in your pitch, because the newcomer hasn't heard a lot of laughter in a long, long time. And they need to know that we enjoy sobriety. Because we do. I enjoy sobriety. We enjoy sobriety. I enjoy living as long as I have, which is amazing. You know, this next September, I'll be 80. And wow, can you believe it? Looking good. I mean, well. It's these two new hips I got. They keep making spare parts. I keep moving. I mean, these hips have moves that I haven't used yet. I mean, I can hardly wait now that Viagra's out. I was talking to me last night, and down south, and this elegant older woman came up to me afterwards, and she said, I mean, she looked so great, and I didn't expect this out of her. She said, you know what you get if you overdose on Viagra? And I said, no, what? She said, a stiff neck. I'll drink to that. Something never changed. This reminds me of, remember the Thunderbird bottles like this? Well, that was a long time ago. I was a Thunderbird freak until they started giving me migraines, and I had to switch to white port. The wines I ended up with never saw a grape. I mean, oh, awful stuff. Well, let's get on with the story. My history in AA is 1970. I took a two-year cake. 1972, I took a two-year cake. 1976, I took a two-year cake. This year, God willing, well, he's willing. If I'm willing, in Christmas Day, I'll take a 24-year cake. So that shows that AA works. It shows that I didn't work it those times that I went out, but it shows that AA works because I'm here today. And don't get the idea that everybody that slips, I slipped after 2 years and after 4.5 years, gets back here, because they don't. I just had two people I know down south. One slipped 23 years sober. She went out, got hooked on Vicodin, and went out. And the other one just drank 32 years sober. And I've known both these ladies. Their whole sobriety, not their whole sobriety, the lady with 32 years had 2 years sober when I originally came in, and I knew her really well. And I'm so sorry to hear that. And I can't reach either one of them. They don't want to be reached at this point. Now, that short time I had, comparatively short time compared to that, and when I went out and drank again, I mean, that old bromide about there's nothing worse than being out there with a body full of alcohol and a head full of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, you know where you belong. You know that you may never see those loving people again. Because you, all of a sudden, you don't realize how much you love those people until you think you've lost them. And it is a horrible feeling. I remember one night I was sitting in a bar, one of my slips, and I happened to look at a clock, and it was 8:30. And I said, uh-oh, give me a double shot. The bartender gave me a double shot, and I got it down. I said, give me another one. I know where I should be. And this guy I was talking to said, what do you mean you know where you should be? I said, I'm a member of AA, and it's 8:30, and I should be in a meeting. I knew I should be in a meeting, but I couldn't stop. I didn't think I could stop, but here I am. That's another story which I hope to get into. I just quit at 11, 12. Anyway, I'm CIA, Catholic Irish alcoholic, and I from this family of 9 of us in the family, 7 alcoholics. I have a mother, father, 2 brothers, and a sister dead of alcoholism, and a sister in a mental institution for alcoholic brain damage. She's been there a long time, but now she has Alzheimer's. She's 92. And then I have another sister still alive. She's 89, and she's in fairly good condition. I saw her couple of months ago, and I went up there. I've reestablished a connection with my family that I really didn't know or much care about, because our family broke up after my mother left when I was 7 and years old, and the family just came unglued, and we were never close, really close. And then when I started into my disease and down the tubes, first very successful, and then slowly going down the tubes as my disease progressed, I lost touch with everybody. And like my oldest sister said, Riley, please stop calling me at 4 o'clock in the morning. Because she said, I have arthritis and I can't get back to sleep. And she said, all you do is call at 4 a.m. and you cry for 20 minutes and hang up. Well, you know the alcoholic. We get black cord fever, telephonitis. We don't know what time it is. And I used to call the mayor of Dublin. He talked to me. That's why I didn't have a phone when I first came to AA. I had to make a $200 deposit before they'd give me one. But I'm from this family, and when my mother left, it broke up early, and it just felt, came unglued, and I sort of raised myself. The nuns and I raised me, God bless the nuns, they were really good to me, and especially this one nun, when I was in the 8th grade, she was assigned to tutor me on Saturdays, because they all got together and decided I should be a priest. Don't you think I should have? What do you mean? Well, anyway, God, I hear enough confessions today from these babies of mine that they tell me more than I would ever tell in confession. I went over there, started going there on Saturdays. One day, she said, Riley, do you have a calling? I said, a what? She said, a calling. Do you feel deep down that you want to be a priest? I said, well, no. I said, not really. They think I should be, and maybe I just thought because they thought I should be, I should be. She said, and you've never really thought of, really felt that you were driven for, that you were meant to be? And I said, not at all. She said, that's all I need to know. Now, before she became a nun, she had been a piano player in an all-girl jazz orchestra. So she started teaching me jazz. She gave me every Saturday. She gave me jazz appreciation classes. So to this day, I'm a jazz freak, and I love that lady. She taught me a lot of good stuff about life. And as a friend of mine says, this lady I know, she said I was taught to be a lady. I was taught to be a woman by those who had given it up. She taught me an appreciation of a lot of things, particularly women. Anyway, I got in and out of this family, and I don't know, I'm getting a little carried away here in nostalgia. Then I got out of school and I was born in the Pacific Northwest. I went to Seattle, and that's where I started drinking. Now, we drank a little in high school then, and I was learned that drinking suited me fine. Drinking took me out of my shyness. Drinking took me to dances. Drinking took me into lots of situations that up to that point I had never even thought I could do. But I felt comfortable drinking. And I didn't drink during the week, and I didn't get drunk all the time. And I went to Seattle and met a lot of more people, and they all were doing stuff. And I just kept drinking a little more and a little more because I have a disease. I don't know I have a disease, but I have a disease. You know, one is too many, a thousand aren't enough. But drinking made me okay. Drinking made me what I've always wanted to be, and that's like you. I mean, outgoing and friendly and warm and have friends and be funny and dance and carry on and have a good time. I mean, I stayed at the party until long after the music stopped. And eventually the war came along. That's the Second World War. One kid asked me once, he said, was it really bad fighting each other during the Civil War? And I said, give me a break. I was in the war, and I was in a port of embarkation, and then they decided I should teach. I never got overseas. And you know what? I wanted to be overseas. I was really stupid. But somebody said to me, Why did you go in the Army? I said, well, there was something existing in those days that you don't see much anymore. I said, he said, what's that? I said, patriotism. I said, when we were hit by Pearl Harbor, We went out there and wanted to defend our country. We wanted to go in there and get in uniform and defend the country. And he said, oh, as if something new had struck him. So anyway, I met a guy in there and said, look, we were working in some sort of a PR deal about overseas broadcasts. And he said, look me up. Have you ever been to California? I said, yeah, I took my basic down there. So he said, well, if you want to... job, I'll give you a job. I work in Los Angeles. And I said, okay. You know, I kept that phone number until I got out of the Army. I got discharged out of New Jersey. I hitchhiked to Seattle, which is another story, and it took me a while. Well, I had a lot of layovers. And I mean, it seemed like everybody that picked me up was drinking. Anyway, so anyway, I came down here, and I called him, and he had a job at Columbia Pictures, and he said, come on over. I went over, and he gave me a dinky little job there. And one dinky job led to a better dinky job, and before you know it. Now, I'm from a poor, shanty Irish family. Poor is below poor. It was charity, And in those days, we had to go out and work on WPA, even when you're this little. I carried water just to get groceries. And we were on charity. And when after my family came unglued, and my dad lost his job from drinking, and we were just totally poor. So I come down here. Oh, I'm all of a sudden, and I'm a kid that loves movies, because that's the only thing I've got. When my family would have parties, I was about 10 years old, I would run over to the bootlegger and get the booze, and I'd get paid for that. And then on Saturday night and Sunday morning, I'd get out of bed, go on, collect up the empty bottles, take them back to the bootlegger, sell the bottles back to him, and then go to church and be an altar boy. Then after I was the altar boy, after Mass, I'd go to the show and spend the rest of the day in the show. And that was before they had talkies. I saw the first talking picture with Al Jolson. And my sister used to play piano at the silent movies, and I'd pull the chain for the fire engine. I'd pull this, do this for the horses coming on. Oh, boy. I was a sound effects man. And didn't know it. And so anyway, I lived in the movies. And oh, God, I just love movies. Then all of a sudden, I'm working in the movies. And before I knew it, one thing led to another. And I was working with some famous people then. Before I knew it again, I had a big house on the hill. And I had a couple of cars. I had an MG with a nice long hood. And I had I had a Chevrolet station wagon with wood sides. One day, I was in Santa Barbara speaking one night with a young gal that's like my daughter, and she was in the audience. We'd had dinner, and we went to the meeting, and I said, I had the MG, and I had a Woody. And everybody did just what you're doing now. And afterwards, I said, I couldn't figure out why they were laughing. And then afterwards, she said, Riley, do you know what a Woody means? And I said, no, besides a station wagon. And she said, I'll tell you. She told me. So now I don't say I've got a Woody, because I don't. Not that I can't. God gives me the words, so... my God's a stand-up comic, I mean... He's a very funny guy. He is. I didn't have him for... Now, he and I are such good friends. So anyway, I had all of that. And you know, long ago, my hero in the movies was a guy named Francis Tone. Now, he was married to Joan Crawford. Now, I had worked on a picture with Joan Crawford, but I had never worked, I'd never seen Franchot Tone, but he was my ideal when I was a kid. Franchot Tone was 30 years old. I wanted to be 30. He was elegant. He wore clothes perfectly, and he always wore tuxedos, it seemed. And he'd lean on the fireplace and drink a martini, you know, and charm the whole room. I mean, all he had to do was just look, and people would pay attention. He was just really a devil. And I said, that's who I want to be when I grow up. I want to be exactly like him. One night, I was in my big house. Now, this front room was big. And I was leaning on the fireplace, and I had a tuxedo on, and I was sipping a martini. And I was, and the reason I had a tuxedo on is because I was going to go to the Academy Awards and work backstage, because my studio was furnishing the limos, and I had to make sure that the most important people got in the first limos. Now, that would drive anybody to drink when you're picking out the most important actor, because they're all the most important. Now, that night I would say, did you? I knew who won, so if you didn't win, you were dead meat. But anyway, so I'm standing there, and I'm everything that I had thought I wanted to be, and I started to cry. I felt such pain. I said, how come I don't feel like he looked? How come I don't have, I'm exactly the same place. I've got what he had, it seemed to have. But I said, it's not working. I said, if they knew what I was like, that I'm just a piece of crap, that I don't know what I'm doing half the time, that I didn't know what I was doing when I came here, and I still don't know what I'm doing because I'm having to drink more and take my pills and do what I'm doing to keep going, because the only way I can do what you want me to do, be what you want me to be, is to put this stuff in me, and it's going, and I need more all the time, and I'm no good without it, and I'm in such pain all the time, I'm fooling you every minute. And I said, I don't know, I'm going to lose all this someday. Now, that was my disease talking to me, because it did, I did lose it, all of it. Now, the pill situation, I was at the studio one day, and I wasn't feeling so great, and I didn't want to drink that day. I had to leave town and then go somewhere on a location, and I had a lot of stuff to do, and so I went to the male nurse at the studio hospital, and I said, look, I need something to keep me going, but not a drink. He said, take this. It was a little diamond-shaped yellow pill, so I took it. Now, in about 40 minutes, I felt great. Quick, but great. And I went back to him and I said, what was that you gave me? He said, a Dexedrine. And I said, how much are they? Now, this is a long time ago. He said, $4 a hundred. I said, I'll have $20 worth. Later on, Dexamil came out, this capsule, you know, spanchels. I'd get up in the morning, I'd break open the capsule, put the beads in the glass, fill it up with vodka, and down the hatch. Now, that's a breakfast of champions. I mean, two of those I get through an eight-hour day in about 20 minutes. I mean, I have a friend, Eddie Cochran, who says, anybody taking Dexamil can thread a sewing machine while it's running. Later on, I went back to him, this nurse. I said, Patrick, I haven't slept in 6 weeks. He said, how come? I said, I've been very busy. Last night I painted my house inside and out. He said, take this. Well, that was in Middletown, same price, $20 worth. And so Middletown is a tranquilizer. It was a tranquilizer of its day, the Prozac of its time, and of its time. And so I, well, I'll tell you, you know, Dexamil made me creative and made me do things. If you want anything done, give it to Riley. You'll get it done yesterday. Now, Dexamil made me creative, but Milltown made me see the truth about everything, about life. It made me heavy, very heavy, and I knew it all. I saw beyond you. I saw in you, beyond you. Anyway, so I had a pocket full of Dexamil, a pocket full of Milltown, and a bottle in each hand, and I was well on my way. Because my choice of chemicals is alcohol, but later on I went back to Patrick and I said, Patrick, I don't want any more pills. I think I don't want to get addicted to them. He says, you've only been taking them 8 years. I said, well, he said, why do you want to stop? I said, because they make me black out before I can drink. And I said, I'm coming to on planes. So I have to ask where we're going. And I was wrecking. I was doing little funny things with my car. And like I was going down the hill one night in this MG with the long hood. And some fool in front of me stopped at a stoplight. And I went around him and across the curb. And it was Christmas week. And I ran into this house. And they were having a party. Unfortunately, the other end of the room, because I ran into the house. But I squeezed out of the car on the outside, and I went over and rang the doorbell. And what can I tell you? I rang the doorbell, and the guy came to the door with a glass in his hand. His eyes were glazed. I said, may I use your phone? And he just pointed. And I walked down the hall and around the front end of my car, which was on top of the Christmas tree. What amazed me, the Christmas tree lights were still blinking. And I went over and I called my sponsor. Lawyer. I wasn't sober. Well, I was sober then. You know what an accident does to you. You're instantly sober. I called my lawyer and I said, Harry, we're in a little trouble. He said, it's 1 o'clock in the morning. What do you mean we're in a little trouble? He said, we're going to court next week for grand theft, and the week after that for drunk driving, and a week after that for vice charge. I said, now that vice was not my fault. That was a case of mistaken identity. I didn't recognize them. Well, sorry, my pills. Anyway, so he said, Hank, give the phone to that guy and get out of there. Go away. So I did. I went up to my sister's in Monterey at the time. She was married to the police judge over there. And I was I got drunk in the motel, and next morning I woke up in a bed full of blood. And I called my sister. She sent a doctor. They got me to the hospital. And the last I heard was, what's his pulse? And the answer was, I can't find one. And I said, thank God, because I can't handle this any longer. I can't pretend any longer. Thank God it's over. And when I came out of that, I went into about 24 or 5 hours later, I was very angry. And you know what? I had to drink 14 more years. Things started going downhill after that. I was doing all these things, I was slowly, slowly coming unglued. I was slowly breaking, fragmenting. Pieces of me were flying all over the place, and I couldn't get them back. And it was taking more stuff and more stuff and more stuff to try to glue it together, and I could not get it glued back together anymore. And it seemed like I went to sleep in this big house, a 10-room house on the hill, with all that stuff, all that those everything going for me, ho-ho. And it just seemed I went to sleep in that house one night, and I woke up the next morning in the drunk tank. Now, this is how quick it seemed to me, because I wasn't paying attention. And I woke up in the drunk tank. I got out of the drunk tank. I staggered over to the nearest blood bank. I sold my blood for $4, and I went over to the nearest Skid Row bar, and I went in, and I ordered a double shot of white port and a double shot of vodka. And I just sat there because I ordered that because I drank the vodka first to see if it would stay down. Then I would drink the vodka. And pretty soon I'd have two or three of those at two bits a shot. And in the Skid Row bar, I'd look in the mirror, and the wine swords would disappear, and I'd gain 20 pounds back, and my clothes would clean up, and my hair would come back, and my teeth would turn white. You know how it is in mirrors. In the bar, you become very handsome eventually. And I'd look in the mirror and say, tomorrow we're going back. Tomorrow is going to be different. Tomorrow I'll get it all back again. But it was all gone. The house, the friends, the money, the cars, the careers, everything gone, gone, everything gone. There was this one wonderful elderly lady that was like a mother to me who let me use the studio in her house in Laurel Canyon, which I used from time to time. And I did that. Sometimes I didn't treat that lady too well, like drunks do. I'd come out of a blackout screaming at her or something, and she'd just cry. And Alcoholics Anonymous gave me the greatest, one of the greatest gifts besides sobriety it gave me was to allow me to take care of her the last 4 years of her life as a sober person. And that was certainly the blessing of all times. That's one of the few things, that's one of the things that AA will do for us. It'll allow us to make the amends in such a way, in such a loving, gentle, warm way that we never thought possible. It wouldn't be possible if we were out there drinking. But so eventually, I knew that I couldn't leave the canyon. I was pulling weeds for $1 an hour. I'd get enough together to go down and buy 2 or 3 or 4 half gallons of vin rosé, and I'd drink that as fast as I could, as much as I could, and pretty soon I couldn't get drunk. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't pass out. I just sat there in total fear, total apprehension, total agony, and knowing, and not, I wasn't even a human being anymore. I could not leave the house. I couldn't even pull a weed. And I said, I'm going to commit myself to Camarillo. If you don't know what Camarillo is, that's the state funny farm. Not so funny. And so I picked up the phone. I had been in AA once before. I came out of a blackout in an AA meeting. I came out of this blackout, and there's this big stage with people on it, and a guy at the podium, and the room was full of people, about twice as many. And the guy was an actor speaking, and I knew him. And I turned to this guy next to me. I said, "What is this, the Screen Actors Guild?" And he said, "No, this is an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting." I said, "Oh, my God, let me out of here. That's enough to drive you to drink." It's like when I first heard the 12 steps, I said, "Hell, I've had worse sentence from the judge than that." Anyway, I lifted up the phone, and I said, "I need the number for Alcoholics Anonymous." Now, I didn't say that. God said that. I didn't. It was a divine shot. It was a spiritual experience that I didn't know at the time. And so she gave me the number, and I said, "I can't dial it. I can't do anything. Will you ring it for me?" She said, "Sure, honey." And she did, and they sent somebody out. Now, I got myself, they said, can you be ready tonight? Are you drinking now?" And I said, "No, I've only had a half gallon." I didn't tell them that. And so I had two half gallons left. So I started getting ready. I drank one other half gallon. And the guy came out, and I just thought they were going to bring me to some dumb basement with a bulb, you know, like we see drunks sobering up at. And they took me to a meeting in Brentwood. It's about 400 people. Brentwood is right between Beverly Hills and Santa Monica, very upscale neighborhood with upscale people. I walked in that. I thought it was the parish of Our Lady of Gucci. I mean, I said, why did you bring me here? Because I looked at you guys, and you were smiling, and you had white teeth and clean clothes, and you were clean, and you were laughing, and you were having a good time. This was not... I said, why did you bring me here? He said, because we love you. We're like you. And I said, oh, no, you're not. You're nothing like me. You don't know what I've done. And this guy says, I know everything you've done, and you haven't told me anything yet. So they brought me in there, and they loved me into sobriety. And I was with a very quite famous group in the West Side, big group, run by a well-known man, and name begins with C. I was with that group for 2 years, and I'll tell you, I'm very grateful to them. They taught me a lot of discipline, and they taught me a lot of responsibility. And I was with them for 2 years, and I had said to, when I got sober, I said, please, God, take away the obsession to drink. And while you're at it, take away that sexual obsession, too, because every night at midnight, I turn into a motel. Now, So be careful what you pray for. He zapped me sober and celibate on the spot. And so after my second birthday cake, I said, I don't want to drink again, but that other thing I'd like back. So that's when I got locked into one of those wonderful coffee break romances. Oh, God, I was a sick. Oh, I mean sick. Possessive and crazed and driving by this person's house after midnight to see if there's a strange car there, maybe. And if there's a light in the bathroom, you sneak over and try to look in those Venetian blinds, and you get hooked up on those damn bushes with a lot of stuff on them. This reminded me of that. No better at it today than I was then. Oh, and finally I got dumped, and that's when I ran off to my sister. My sister's husband died, and I ran up to Northern California. Now, she's a falling down pillhead drunk. She's now 92. But she was a falling down pillhead drunk, and she used to be my drinking buddy. I'm 2 years sober, see? And I said, wow, how awful. Because you know I'm 2 years sober, I got all the answers. Be careful. At three, they change the questions. So, one day I was walking down by the river. On the way home, I saw her French poodle standing on the front porch, and I said, Jesus, that dog has a lot of teeth. Well, I got closer, and her dog was carrying my sister's upper plate around. Perfectly. It ran smiling down the road, wagging its little tail, and I went in the house. Now I was not a vision for you at this point, nor was I a program of attraction. There's my sister crawling around the floor looking for something. Now she's hungover, poor thing, wig on tilt, and eyelashes over here, you know, or down here. I felt mean. I said, Ann, what are you looking for? And she said, I'm looking for my false teeth. And I said, the last time I saw your false teeth, they were chasing a cat down the road. That was not nice. She said, just get out of here. Riley, get out of here. You won't drink with me anymore. You're not nice. You talk bad to me. Ever since you went to that A&A place, I don't want you here. Just get out. Now, did I call my sponsor down here? No. Did I ask God for help? No. Now, you see, I am an Irish Catholic. I know prayer. I believe in God. But I don't know about spiritual. I don't know that I have a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. And it says a little later that there may come a time when there will be no mentally effective defense against that first drink unless you turn to a power greater than yourself. I had not remembered that. I had not been praying. I had not been meditating. So, I did not come down here. Now, I'm an Irishman, you know. And I have a definition of Irish. The Irish go around with a sense of tragedy that sustains them in their brief moments of happiness. I'm going to write a book called How to Overcome Peace of Mind. Subtitled, Creative Suffering. Anyway, so I left her, went to San Francisco to catch a plane to go back here, down home, and I'm staying in front of the St. Francis Hotel where I used to stay, and I said those three fatal words that no recovering alcoholic should ever say. I said, what's the use? I don't feel like they feel. At the meetings, I'm active, I'm into everything, I'm out seven nights a week, I've got commitments, I'm on panels, I'm an H&I, I'm doing it all, and I go home at night in such pain I can't sleep, and I cry every night. I said, what's the use? And I turned around, walked in the bar, and got drunk. Now, I was thinking one day, I was sitting in the bar, I said, gee, I don't have to tell them, I can sober up and go back. I forget that when I get drunk, I black out and make a lot of phone calls. Now, there were two people waiting for me at the plane, and I didn't even know they knew. Anyway, when I came back, started over, 4.5 more years under the same circumstances, didn't realize that I had not asked my higher power for help. I had not asked anybody for help. I don't ask people for help. I don't know about that. All I know is being active as having an AA image. Just having looking good all the time in the meetings or at the conventions. I was involved in all of it. Looking good and dying. You could do that, but not for long. Finally, my dear friend was dying, begging me to pull the tubes. I wasn't telling anybody that. I was going to meetings every night. I was secretary, I was speaking a little, secretary of the biggest meeting in L.A., doing it all. I went home one night, and finally the rage that I had been pushing down all this time started to boil up, and I just went into a total outburst of rage at God. I said, how dare you do this to her? How dare you do this to me? Every time I get somebody in my life that I love so much, you take them away from me. How dare you? It's as if, like, after all I've done for you. Now, and I went into a sober blackout. You can, if you're bearing rage, it can destroy you. And I came out of it a seconds later with an empty bottle of Listerine in my hand, which I had chugged along. Now, Listerine in the rocks is not my favorite drink. I got to wrap it up here. Sorry about that. So anyway, it got me to the liquor store, and I got enough booze to go home, lock the door, turn off the lights, disconnect the phone, park my car up the street. I had a car. When I came in, I didn't have anything. And commit suicide the only way the Catholic Church allows, which is drink yourself to death. Now, is there a crucifix? There's usually a crucifix behind me, and I shudder when I say that. And I was well on my way, because you can drink yourself to death. You dehydrate, your organs just stop working. And so four people who loved me so much, and they missed me because I was active, but they loved me so much they came looking for me, and they broke in the door and came in, And that was total unconditional AA love. They loved me no matter what. I was drunk, and I told them, I don't want to live. I didn't drink because I wanted to drink. I drank because I don't want to live. And they said, why don't you want to live? I said, because I can't seem to stay sober. And if I can't be sober, there's no point in living. If I can't have AA, there's no point in living. And I didn't think I could have AA. I didn't think I was good enough. I didn't think I could do it. And they said, yes, you can. We know you can. We know that deep down in you, there's a spark there, just like there is in us, that's going to respond. We're going to take you home, and you're going to be sober, and you're going to stay sober. And they took me home, and they said, open the book and do whatever it tells you on that, whatever you open it at. So I opened the book, and out popped a sentence that said, we will have tapped an unsuspected inner resource. I said, wow, they added that while I was out. It's in the spiritual experience. And I said, that's it. I was born with spirit, I live with spirit, and it may go on for all I know. But this spirit is within. It's not out there somewhere. It's not in a church. It's in here, and it's in everybody, and I live with that spirit, and that spirit wants nothing but good for me. That spirit, I am its perfect child. It will give me whatever I need. I said, that's it. I can pray to this spirit because it loves me, and that's my higher power. And you know, that's when I began to get total sobriety, because up to that point, I only had physical sobriety. And I began to get spiritual sobriety. Then when I started getting spiritual sobriety, I got emotional sobriety, because to me, emotional sobriety, I figured it out for me that if I can trust God and God's in you, then I can trust you. I can tell you my pain. I can tell you my frustrations. I can tell you everything, some of you. I can tell you anything and everything, and you will understand, and you'll respect me. You won't put me down. You'll respect me for telling you, as I respect you for telling me. And that's when I began to get total sobriety. And I'll tell you, these last 23 years have been the yellow brick road, with a few detours into Dante's Inferno. But I've had 3 hip replacements. 1 got loose. I've had spinal surgery. I've had cancer twice. That's why Viagra is so, that's good news. And I don't know why that's in my mind. I hope it just stays there. I had dreadful skin cancer. I had had to go through all that, taking it off, getting rid of that. And my sponsor died, and I wasn't through with him yet. And I was angry about that. I have had friends go out and get drunk and not come back, and they've died. But you know what? And I've gotten jobs and lost jobs and gotten better jobs, and I've had to quit jobs because of my health, when my health started going down. Here's for hope for you in your ninth, in your eighth year. In my ninth year, it was my suicidal year. I won't tell you that. I don't have time for that story, but I survived it. And I was on food stamps my night. I mean, everything came crashing down. My health fell. I was an old man at 60 or something when I was younger. And then all this stuff, I decided, as I was telling Warren, I decided to turn it around when the surgery started working. I said, I will not be a cripple. I will not be an old person like I see other old people around me that today I am taking to meetings and taking to hospitals, and they're my age or younger because they've given up. I will not give up. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me respect for my body. And if I have respect for my body, I'm going to take care of it. It's given me something that I never dreamed I'd ever have, which is health at nearly 80 years old, let alone living that long. And I am totally thrilled with being alive today. I'm totally thrilled with it. In and out of these relationships, praying to get them back one time. God, never pray to get them back. So they come back. The whole thing. I've been through it all. And the pain has been so great, I thought it would never end. I've been on the floor clutching the rug, falling into that total hopeless despair. and survived it. You can survive anything in here. I know there's some people in here at this moment who are in deep pain. Don't drink, don't use, and get through it. Talk to somebody about it. There's someone in these rooms who would be glad to hear what you have to share because they've been there. Even if they haven't been there, they will help you. Talk to them. Don't hold it inside because you bottle it up until you have to drink it. And that was the bottom line with me. Please, and keep your sense of humor. By all means, learn to laugh at yourself. I laugh at myself a lot. I laugh at you more, but I laugh at myself a lot. And just remember one thing. When you die and you go to heaven, God's going to ask you one thing. He's going to say to you, did you enjoy the joke? If he says, if you say, I didn't get it, he's probably going to send you back and make you do it all over again, including your first 30 days. So get the joke. I love you guys. Thank you for having me.